Thursday the 25th of February, Yud Aleph. Adar, Tanis Esther Mukdam, Rabbi Svi Belovsky, Purim at the Gates of Destruction, Thoughts from the Eish, Kodesh.
Good morning. I'd like to share with you a few thoughts from a remarkable work that you may be familiar, the Eish Kodesh. A little bit of background. The Eish Kodesh is really the last testimony of Rav Kolonimus Kalmish Shapira, the Rebbe of Piasetzna, who was murdered by the Nazis at the end of 1943. He was a remarkable progressive thinker. He wrote the Chovetz Talmidim, which is a fascinating work of educational theory, which was the only work that was published in his lifetime, published in the early 30s. But he was a prolific writer and thinker, teacher. There are still some elderly people around who remember him, remember his world. And he spent the early war years in the Warsaw Ghetto, and then was eventually deported in early 1943. Around 1950, a worker rebuilding the ruins of Warsaw discovered a canister. This canister contained some Hebrew writings, substantial Hebrew writings, together with a covering letter in Yiddish. Asked the finder to either return them to the author should he survive the war, which he didn't, or to send them to his brother who had published his earlier work in Tel Aviv. These works he described, they were various works of educational theory which subsequently published, and also a book that he calls Chidushei Torah from the years Tofshin to Tofshin Beis. That was published later on as Eish Kodesh. The title is the title of the publisher rather than that of the author. And they are remarkable insights. They follow the Seder HaParshios and the Yom Tovim, like all these works, but they are incredibly aware and sensitive to the realities of the horrors of the people who are suffering. They don't just pronounce, as it were, as many of these sorts of works from a distance. There are many, if you like, what might call Holocaust theologies. And they often are pronouncing at a distance. This is a man who's experiencing it. He lost almost all of his immediate family in bomb attacks in September 1939. And he himself was very gravely ill, as was his son-in-law, the only really immediate surviving relative, although they both recovered, both only to be murdered later. And his insights, self-awareness, his sensitivity to suffering and people's inability to really live a meaningful religious life due to the incredibly unpleasant circumstances is remarkable and in many ways makes this unique. What does the Eish Kodesh do with Purim? Purim, the time of unbridled simcha, of really kind of revelry, of enthusiasm and excitement of all times of the year, one must think that Purim's got to be the most difficult to celebrate, to find meaning. In the Eish Kodesh, there are two essays on Purim, one written in Purim 1940 and the other Purim 1942. And let's learn them. It seems to be an appropriate prelude to Purim, a new way of thinking of Purim, and also something which was introspective for the Tanis. So a short mimer written, as you can see, exactly 70 years ago, Purim 1940. He creates an inspirational mimer based on the well-known mimer of the Tikkuni Zohar, Purim Kiyom HaKippurim. Comes the Tikkuni Zohar, and he says, Isa b'Tikkuni Zohar, Kodesh Purim Kiyom HaKippurim. Purim is like Yom Kippur. Now, there are numerous explanations of this. I'm sure in various states of inebriation you've come up with your own. And if you haven't, then I recommend you consider that for your Purim Suda. The normal understanding, my Rebbe Rabbi Miller Zeksad Bivrocha used to say that the key understanding of this is the Goyrol, that the central theme of Yom Kippur, the Goyrol on the goats, and the Goyrol, which is the central theme, if you like, the way Haman decides how and when to kill the Jews, after which the festival is named. He said one has to focus on the Goyrol. But there are many other interpretations that link Purim to Yom Kippur, and this is his. Efshe Meramiz Gam Lozer. as well as the standard explanations as a remez in this comparison, the Tikkunim. Shekamo Yom Kippurim Atanis Vatshuva B'Yom Zeh, just as on Yom Kippur, the fast and the tshuva on that day, Lo Yim Roitza Oysam O'Odom La'asoysam Oysa, Rak Benim Roitza Ben Loi. You don't only do it if you fancy. Get up in the morning of Yom Kippur and you think, well, I'm not sure I really fancy doing this today. It's not optional. You do it anyway, whether you want it or not. Whether you feel like fasting, whether you feel like doing tshuva, that's just what you do. Why? One does it because this is what God wants. This is the will of a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Gam kein Simchas Purim. So too Simchas Purim. And now he acknowledges that there are various states of mind. And it's evident from the way he writes that he's often speaking about his own variable state of mind. But he's also validating the fact that not everyone can be in a state of religious ecstasy all the time, particularly when they're enduring such awful suffering. You have to fulfill some element of Simchas Purim, not only if the person is intrinsically in a state of Simcha. Oi, now the second state of mind, O al kalponim, the matzav shiochol is smoich es atzmoi, or at least in a circumstance that he's capable of making himself rejoice. That's the second stage. You're not in the state of Simcha, but you're capable of pressing the right buttons, doing the right thing to generate Simcha. Even if you're not in either of those kind of circumstances, Sorachul is smoyach. It's not just those situations in which one needs to rejoice. Rakigamin hu b'shiflus, u'b'shvirus ha'lev, ha'moyach v'kol ruchoi nirmas. But even if one is in a lowly state, broken-hearted, his mind and his spirit is crushed, despite that, just as with the Yom Kippur, that the Tanis and Tshuva are mandatory and not optional, Choyku Shatzorich Al Kol Ponim Mitzus Shel Simcho Lahachnis El Liboy. At the very least, one is required to create a spark of Simcha, to allow a spark of Simcha to enter one's heart. See, he's validating, first of all, the fact that people are not finding life easy, that there are kind of, perhaps, one consider them from some perspectives, rather unrealistic perspectives, that no matter the suffering, no matter the circumstance, no matter the hopelessness, no matter, as he says elsewhere, how relentless the persecution is, you should be in this constant state of dvekus. Well, maybe he was or maybe he wasn't, but he acknowledges at least that that is not the way everyone is, and he finds a mode of engagement for everyone, even those people, as he describes them, who are in a lowly state, broken-hearted, with mind and spirit crushed. Nonetheless, having validated that there are people in that circumstance, you have to find some nitzus of simcha. Now, someone pointed out to me that, of course, you could say this idea about any halachic obligation. If you don't feel like it, you've got to do it anyway. But he really uses the comparison to Yom Kippur for the next short paragraph. V'chein gam mimala lamato. Because his way is to provide a sense of hope tempered by realism. That is very much his mahalach. This is we've seen the realism. What's the hope? V'chein gam mimala lamato. The same thing works, as it were, from the flow that comes from above to below, the downward focused divine flow. One of the principles of Yom Kippur is the day itself a false atonement. So even if you don't know it's Yom Kippur, even if you're in bed, it has some impact. For Athena, the way he casts it, Imloihishlim Kol Teshuvosoi. The person's got a whole long list of tikkunim that he wishes to effect on Yom Kippur. Things which he wishes to rectify, to change, to improve. And he doesn't get through the whole list on Yom Kippur. By the end of the day, he hasn't finished the job. Loihishlim Kol Teshuvosoi. In that circumstance, Oymer Rebbe quotes the Gemara in Yuma Daf Pehei. Rebbe says, Shemachapiloi, nonetheless Yom Kippur atones for those things, the incomplete part of his objective. He says, and therefore, if Purim is like Yom Kippur, and you can't do the job properly, it will still work. That's the powerful message. Kein gam b'Purim, so too on Purim. Even if the Jew is not in a state of simcha as he ought to be. Umimelo, and as a result, it's a very interesting perspective, that attaining that ecstatic state, being this in this kind of state of dvekas, almost otherworldly dvekas, that is the objective of Purim, and if that is not achieved, as he puts it, mimelo kol avodosa sheba Purim lo hoiso b'shleimus, that means the entire avoda of Purim has not been complete, he has not finished the job. Mikol mokoim, nonetheless, because of the comparison to the way Yom Kippur works, you can't do the whole job. You can only generate just a nitzutz of simcha. Just a little simcha. HaYeshua, vahasimcha shapurim poel al Yisrael, gam ato poel v'oiseh. The salvation and the rejoicing that Purim affects upon the Jewish people will now work as well. It's a combination of inspiration and realism. He validates the fact there are people in a whole range of situations. Even if you're not in a state of constant simcha, perhaps there are people who are able to generate simcha. And even if you feel you're not able to generate simcha because of crushing outside circumstances, of which we'll speak more in the second mimer, if you can generate just a little, then the principle of Itzuma Shel Yom Mechaper will be extended from Yom Kippur into Purim through this, the lens of the Tikkunim, that Purim is like Yom Kippur. And that little bit, Kodesh Baruch Hu will complete the job. Will complete the job. It's a very, very powerful message. That is how he's thinking near the beginning of the war. He has suffered very, very significant personal loss. He loses, I think, 4 or 5 immediate family members right at the beginning of the war in aerial attacks from Germans. And it's unknown to what extent he is offering inspiration to others or really speaking to himself, by which he can also inspire others. But that is how, at the beginning of the war, he sees the job. He acknowledges, and that's what he does throughout the work, he acknowledges the fact that being in a state of dvekas, incapable of thinking in a religious mode, even motivating oneself in the most basic religious observances sometimes can be very difficult. And by the final words of the book, which are written as a footnote in 1943, he's acknowledging that the motivation for religious life is already deteriorated. And he's not saying that's okay, but he at least allows people who are experiencing, if you like, religious doubt, to feel included and part of the Jewish world. And he can even create a Purim for them. Now the second mime on Purim in the Eish Kodesh was written 2 years later, by which time the circumstances were very much worse. And he uses what I would describe as an obscure liturgical diuk to build a very powerful idea. The diuk is, he's trying to work out the structure of the Piyut Shoshanas Yaakov. So he's interested in the first 2 lines. Actually, Shoshanas Yaakov is the end of a much longer piyut, but the bit that with which we're familiar, Shoshanas Yaakov, Tzol of Sameicha, Shoshanas Yaakov is a poetic reference to the Jewish people. The Jewish people, Tzol of Sameicha, cried out and rejoiced, Biroisom Yachad Techeles Mordechai, when they saw together the blue robe of Mordechai, a reference to the possible Mordechai Yotzom Elifnei Amelech. Teshuasom Hoyisol Netzach, their salvation was eternal, the Sikvosom Bechol Dor Vodor, and their hope throughout every generation. That's the bit he's interested in, which I'm sure is familiar. So he asks this question, Shoshan Siakov Slava Samecho Berosim Yachat Kalev Techeles Mordechel, Ikan Simchosom Hoyisom Mishuosom. The Simcha surely was the fact they were saved. I mean, would they rejoice when they saw him in a blue robe? I would have thought they would have rejoiced when they discovered they weren't going to be killed. That's his question. That was the main simcha. It was not because of Mordechai's new clothes, but because they were saved. Not only that, he mentions their salvation, but he puts it afterwards. Having celebrated Techeles Mordechai, it then goes on. So now he returns to his realism. He quotes the Pasuk, And he's interested in the use of this verb yatov, to be kind of wrapped, to somehow be encompassed. And he identifies three stages of Yisurim, three levels of suffering, and he obviously is allowing his audience to identify the circumstances in the Warsaw Ghetto in 1942 with the last stage, as you're about to see. Ki shaboy Yisurim ma'atim al ha'odom chas v'sholem. When small suffering comes upon a person, oz yochol la'astir and bekirba, one can keep it within. One can conceal it. One can manage it, if you like. Because they are smaller than oneself, and one can therefore contain it. And when they become greater, this stage two, kvar ein yochol lahastirom, it's no longer possible to conceal them. There comes a point where a person's suffering becomes overwhelming, overpowering. Becomes necessary. The person feels compelled to talk about what's happening and to cry or to bewail his circumstances, but there comes a point where it's no longer able to contain. Because they have become so many that he can no longer contain them. Masha Einkein, and he's obviously, as I said, really referring to his own circumstances now in stage three. Masha Einkein, he just Rabban Chas v'Sholem Odiyose. But that's not the case when they become even greater. Oz he makifim oisoi. Then they surround the person. They envelop and completely overwhelm the person. Kuloi mu'utav by, and one becomes totally enveloped, totally, if you like, stifled by them. And he returns to this theme many times in the book, the idea that people reach a stage where they can't speak. They become incapable of any kind of really thought beyond the immediate, become totally incapable of religious life, totally stifled and surrounded, overwhelmed, if you like, by their suffering. As he says, Oz he makifin oisai v'kula ma'utav bohem. So he says this is the tefillah lo onikiyato, if the person has been kind of surrounded, and so on. And he even says something here which I think in some places might seem an unpopular comparison. He says, the potter continues, l'chein lifnei Hashem yishpoich sichoi, he will pour out his conversation before God, which he understands to be sheshoveh his kolatzmoi. He pours out his whole self. He completely gives himself over. Kamosh Omer Mizmor, as he says in the Mizmor Tehillim, it's in Chav Beis, Keili Keili Lomo Azov Tani, suggesting the person reaches a stage where they begin to feel that God has abandoned them. So he's not validating that as an acceptable way of thinking, but he's acknowledging and allowing people who think like this inevitably to feel understood and to feel still as participating members of the community. But then he plays his trump card. He said, if that's the case about suffering and Yisurim, Chein Lehepach, it must be the same the other way around. And he's going to lead it back to some kind of inspiration of thought for Purim. Kashem Oizel Ish, Rak Yeshua Ketzana Kavitzok Yosef. When God helps a person and gives him a Yeshua, which is commensurate only with his needs, also makivisa Yeshua Shabbalai, he encompasses the salvation. It's just something which is inside. Something went wrong, something is addressed, and it remains within. But if God helps the person and gives a Yeshua, which is beyond his immediate needs, then also Yeshua kefisoso, the Yeshua will surround him. It's overpowering and overwhelming. Then he goes off into what I would describe as a Kabbalistic digression, in which he talks about the difference between Or Panimi and Or Makif. Or Panimi is a kind of internal sense of spiritual well-being, but it's something which is contained. Or Makif is a surrounding spiritual light. And having described that distinction, what he's really interested in is pointing out that Or Panimi is quite specific, whereas Or Makif is indiscriminate. That means that there can be a type of Yeshua which is not contingent on circumstance, not contingent on merit, and that's the idea that he wants to bring out. But before he finally does that, he explains a curious distinction that I had never thought of, I don't know whether you'd thought of it, between Chanukah and Purim. Esher Bishvil Zeh, having given you this distinction between the two types of oil, it's possible because of this. B'nais Chanukah Shai Be'eretz Yisrael B'zman Shebeis HaMikdosh. All Chanukah, the miracle happened in Eretz Yisrael, in the temple era. Mikol Mokom Hoyosu Yeshuasom Raka Fitzroch Yosef. So he suggests that their Yeshua was just commensurate with their needs, Bilvad. He said, Shilishtachru Minso Nehem Shaboy Alehem. They were people who persecuted them, and they disposed of them. They didn't conquer the lands of their enemies. It was a limited Yeshua, which was relative to the circumstances and the need. There was a problem, the problem was dealt with. Masha Ein Kibbutz Purim. But Purim is different. Shoyub the Eretz Amamin, they were living in Gentile land, and he's trying to liken this to their own circumstances. Va'akati Avdi Achashverun Anon, you may know this phrase, it comes from the Gemara, that those still remained oppressed under the thumb of Achashverosh, that's actually one of the reasons given why we don't say Hallel, but they remained in alien lands, and they were still, as it were, in control of others. Mikol Mokum, nonetheless, Lo Bilvad Shechsor Hiseihem Nismalu. It wasn't just that God gave them their immediate needs, which was what? Lo Holgoi, so it didn't kill them. They were under threat of death. It wasn't just that the threat of death was removed. Rak, what does the Pasuk say? V'nafachu Asher Yishatu HaYehudim Hema B'Soina Ehem. Things were totally reversed. And the Jews, Yishatu B'Soina Ehem, they would be expressed dominion, control over their enemies, and were even able to eliminate them. It goes beyond their immediate needs. Chanukah he describes as a limited oil, whereas Purim is something which is overwhelming and indiscriminate. And therefore, Purim, you might have thought, intuitively, they're alienated, they're living in another land, it's a time of exile, a time of Hest upon him. You might have thought that they were less roy, less fitting for some kind of intervention, and yet you can see from the story that Chanukah in Eretz Yisrael with the Beis HaMikdosh was an intervention which simply dealt with the immediate need, whereas Purim in Eretz Amamim, in exile, in the state of Hester, they were able to attract what he will call the Or Makif, some kind of indiscriminate salvation. And of course what he's doing by this is suggesting that this Purim experience could be repeated. That even as he says at the end of this paragraph, because there were kitrugim against them, accusations, there were genuine tainas against them, and yet, nonetheless, Kodesh Baruch Hu intervened and gave this Yeshua of the Or Makif variety. What he's trying to say, of course, is that we don't know why this is happening to us. Maybe there's some kind of kitrug against us. But the Purim story teaches that even when we're alienated from our Kodesh Baruch Hu, even if there are people who do not merit, even if there are people he's talking to who are not able to maintain their religious life in the way it should be, it's still possible, which of course he's saying, without saying it, that his hope is not simply that they'll be freed from the ghetto, but that their enemies will also be eliminated, and Purim is the precedent for that experience. And he's saying, don't feel that the extent of our alienation indicates that that's unlikely, it might be counterintuitive, but that's the story of Purim. He said, now I'm ready, having used this question as a springboard for the idea, I'm ready to go back to the original question. Why is the text Shoshanas Yaakov, which is quite ancient, why is it structured in this way? Why is it that they're Solova Samecho Biroisum Yacha Techedus Mordechai? Shekasher Ro Shegam Bapon Slavish Big Deyesha. He said, you see, the way he puts it, is the fact that Mordecai is dressed in his royal robes and becomes the vizier instead of Haman is a simon for the nature of the Yeshua. Okay, they could have celebrated the fact that the decree is torn up, the Jews are allowed to fight back, and that the decree is rescinded, they're not killed anymore. But that would indicate it will be a Hanukkah-type experience. But when they see that things far exceed their immediate need, of which the simon is Birosa Miachad to Chelas Mordechai, doesn't mean they were sorted, it means they understood what it meant. It was a simon for the nature of the divine intervention. Rosh Gamba Polish Labish Bediesh, he was dressed up in this way. Hevino they understood, Shubachinus Ermakiv Bo Yeshuasom, that their salvation was of the indiscriminate type, which can come and overwhelm people no matter the circumstances, no matter whether they are Kitrugim or Dinim against them. When they saw that, they understood it. And they celebrated Shevinu Teshuasom Tielam Netzach, Sitrosom Bechol Dor. He says, what it's telling you is that when they saw Mordechai dressed in this way, they knew this was a remarkable, an unusual, extraordinary type of Yeshua, and they understood that that Yeshua could be an inspiration for all the generations. And therefore, once they saw Techelas Mordechai, Teshuasom Hoyesod Netzach, V'sikvosom V'chol Dor V'dor. Of course, what he's trying to say is that it can happen again. Our circumstances are the same. We don't know why this, and they may be dealing against us, but the Purim story, the celebration of Purim, be a recognition that there is a precedent for the sort of Yeshua that we need, and that we can, as it were, feel hope that even though the circumstances are dire, it's happened before, and it can happen again. And he says, Uveim Roim Legamri, and whether one is entirely meritorious, Ubein Shrehoi Adoy Roy Legamri, or if not, Timshok Yeshua Mipurim Lechol Doyrus Misrael. This type of Yeshua, as we've described already, that can extend from Purim. That's what Purim introduces to history, if you like. That's what it's about. This concept, which can extend and remains a part of reality and a possibility throughout all of history, and can emerge and reappear in any generation of Jewish history. Kivin Shal Purim Hoysa Yeshua Mibachinas Armakif. Since then at the Purim time, the salvation came from the Or Makif, this indiscriminate salvation, which far exceeded their needs, where Pagam, Kitrug, problems, of which I believe he's hinting to the fact he's speaking to an audience of people in very varied religious conditions, some people who have lost their ability to be religious, which he speaks about explicitly elsewhere. Nonetheless, we're all part of that, and irrespective if there's Pagam or Kitrug, it's a Yeshua, which is Rak Tomid Nimsheches, which continues and becomes a feature of Jewish history. And so, apart from being, as far as I can see, a remarkable kind of picking out a remarkable nekuda about the Purim salvation in comparison with Hanukkah, something which I've never thought of and I found quite inspirational. It's also remarkable what he's done, that he's created, as I say, this kind of relationship between spirit, inspiration, and realism. He validates the way people are feeling. He acknowledges that they feel excluded, alienated, perhaps from their more observant peers, from a Kodesh Baruch Hu. And then he finds a parallel. How are we going to celebrate Purim in the Warsaw Ghetto in 1942, when things only appear to be going in one direction? The answer is that Purim can become a template, an archetype, for the sort of salvation they feel they need. People can feel included, can feel loved, and irrespective of the reason, which he doesn't even address in this, or attempt to address really anywhere, why these events may be unfolding, there is still hope. Chuosum hoysol and it's lo netzach, visit vosum behold over dio. Freilich and Purim.